Good morning.
It's good to be here with you. As Jason mentioned, I now run a nonprofit where we help churches work together to serve locally in the Denver area. Previous to that, I served as a pastor for 10 years. I worked at two great churches, but something happened to me that changed the trajectory of my life. I got obsessed with this one scripture, this one prayer that Jesus prays. It's found in John chapter 17. I remember I was sitting there, I was reading through the text. I come to this chapter. It's the last recorded prayer of Jesus before he's arrested. In this chapter, he prays for himself, for what he's getting ready to go through. He prays for the disciples, and then he prays for all of us. He prays for every believer alive at that time and every believer to come. And in that prayer, he simply prays for unity. He prays for oneness among us, among his followers. He doesn't just pray for unity for the sake of unity. He prays for unity. He says, when there's unity among my people, in some beautiful, mystical, sacred way, people that don't know God will be sucked towards him. And I just sat there as a pastor thinking about all the things that I was up to. I just thought to myself, what if this is actually true? What if one of the best things that we can do to see people move closer to God is simply be one with the people who are already following him? And I started going to bed at night thinking about that scripture. I started waking up in the morning thinking about that scripture. I started hanging out with other pastors in town, and we started to talk about what would it look like to live this out. What would it look like if in one specific geographic area, a group of faith leaders would stack hands and say, we're going to change our city together. We're going to make the gospel tangible. And a lot of us started to get really excited about that idea. And we had this horrible realization. We didn't know our city well enough to know what the thing is that we should be doing. Have you ever thought about that? Like, if you could mobilize the body in this entire area, what's the smartest thing that you would do? What's the felt need? What's the systemic issue that you would go after if you really wanted to restore and renew this city? And we started to ask that, and when we realized we didn't know the answer, we started to reach out to local government leaders. So we would bring all the pastors together, and we'd invite in the city manager, the police chief. About 7 years ago, I'm sitting in a room with our mayor. There's about 22 lead pastors sitting in the room. And we asked him, hey, what's your dream for our city? And then we asked him the second question. I said, if you could wave a magic wand and change something about our community, what would you change? And when we asked him that second question, we all got out our little pen and paper because we're like, this is it. We're going to find out our thing that we're going to do. And we told him what we were going to ask him. So he had brought this list. And he brings this list out of his back pocket and he starts reading it. He said, I want to live in a city where there's no elderly shut-ins. I want to live in a city where there's no single moms who live below the poverty line, where there's no financial debt, where there's no at-risk kids. And then he just goes on. Most of it was really good. And then there's some weird stuff on there too. He's like, we need a better newspaper. We're like, we're pastors. We can't help you with that. He takes this piece of paper, he folds it up, puts it in his back pocket, and he just says something very much in passing. He said, you know, if you guys want to have the biggest impact on our community, you'd start some kind of neighboring movement. And then he just kind of goes on to the next thing. We're like, whoa, what? He said, yeah, you know, neighboring solves a lot of problems. He said this beautiful way. He said, the majority of the issues in our community is facing would be eliminated or drastically reduced if we could just become a community of people who are great neighbors. So we could start another program for elderly shut-ins in our city. Or that person who's growing older and who's becoming more and more isolated could live on a block where they're known by the people who live right around them. We'd start another Boys and Girls Club. Or that kid who's missing a father figure in their life could live on a block where other healthy adults are bringing that kid into the life, the fabric of their family. And he said this beautiful line. He said, at the city, we're just learning that relationships always trump programs. Now, I want you to put yourself in that room with me and my friends and our mayor. Imagine for a second, what you do for a living is that you're a pastor. You help people to live out the teachings of this book. Now imagine what it feels like when God uses your mayor to tell you that the best thing you can do is the thing that this book says matters most. You know, like actually love your neighbor. Do you know what that feels like? It feels horrible. It feels like you got punched in the gut. You ever had a moment like that? You have this metaphorical kind of like gut punch, and it hurts, and you also realize there's something sacred here. There's something I need to lean into here. That's what happened to us. And so we get to the end of that meeting, our mayor leaves, and we all just sit there embarrassed and convicted and looking at each other going, what are we going to do with this? And we just made a commitment that we would pray for a couple months, and we'd get back together, and we'd talk. And I'll never forget, I'm driving home from that meeting, I'm driving back into my suburban neighborhood, to my little cul-de-sac where I live, and there's a bunch of thoughts that are running through my head, but one of the thoughts is this: Jesus is smart. Like, you'd think I'd know that as a pastor, right? But I'm just sitting there in awe. I'm like, Jesus is smart. When he gets asked to boil the entire Bible down to one thing, is it possible that what he said is actually a very simple strategic plan that if we did it, it would change the world overnight? So that was my first thought. My second thought is this: I'm driving back into my neighborhood and I realize I wasn't doing it. I was involved in a lot of good things. I was serving on the board of three different nonprofits. As a pastor, I was deeply involved in like people's lives and their marriages and their life with their kids. At my church, I was putting on outreach events, hoping, like having my fingers crossed, that just maybe somebody that didn't know God would walk in the doors to our church. But I was putting almost zero intentionality into what was going on my block. And I walked into my house and I told my wife, Lauren, what had happened. My wife is ahead of me on most things, and she was ahead of me on this, on literal neighboring, and she just said, well, what are you going to do about that? And so I made a decision that day. I said, I'm going to do this one-year experiment. I'm going to try to say no to a few things. I'm going to try to be a little bit more present in my front yard, and then just see what happens, see what doors open up. And that one-year experiment has turned into a seven-year experiment, and it's totally screwed up my whole life. And I don't want to go back. God has used this to teach me that if you take the second half of the Great Commandment seriously and literally, that it is messy, that it will screw up your life, and it's also beautiful, and it's powerful, and it's actually the best way to live. And that's what my friends and I found out that were sitting in that room that day. So we decided that we'd meet again in 2 months. So we gather. Now, I'd been going around asking all these people at the city level. I'd been annoying them with that magic wand question. And so this one lady, everybody would tell me, go talk to Vicky, go talk to Vicky. She was the assistant city manager. Vicky was kind of like the bridge between everything that happens in our city and then like the bureaucracy that happens with local government stuff. And so I'd always go to Vicky and I'd ask her the magic wand question. She'd always say the same thing. She goes, Dave, you know what you should do when all those people come and hang out at your churches every week? Why don't you tell them that next time it snows, that they should shovel their neighbor's driveway? Now, I know that doesn't mean a lot here since I'm in Florida. Just imagine you're in Colorado, okay? And when she would say that to me, I would just think, nah, that's not it. Like, I wanted something sexy. Like, I wanted to, like, eradicate something off the face of the city. This neighboring thing just kind of seemed like, eh. Then we're sitting in that room, and the mayor says what he said, and I just realized, oh my goodness, Vicky knows this. Vicky has this. What I learned later, Vicky had been like poisoning everyone in the city around this idea of literal neighboring. And so we invite Vicky to come to the second meeting. We all gather, and Vicky comes in, and she just starts like knocking our socks off with all these reasons that neighboring is so important, all these really pragmatic reasons. The fact that in neighborhoods where people know the first names of their neighbors, the crime rate is 80% less. That when there's a crisis, your neighbor is almost always your first responder because the systems are overwhelmed. That people live significantly longer if they're connected to their actual neighbors. And the whole time we're just listening to her going, that's good, that's good, that's good. And but in the back of our mind, we're going, and Jesus said to do this. We're just sitting there in that moment thinking, oh my goodness. And I'm reminded once again that Jesus is smart.
And then what cements what happened later in our city is this one little thing that Vicky says in passing. She's talking to one of the pastors. And she wasn't trying to be mean, but she just looked at him and said, "Hey, you don't think that like where we sit at the city level that we can see a drastic difference in the way Christians and non-Christians treat their actual neighbors, do you?" And it felt so bad to hear someone say that we started to argue with her about her perception. Is there a noticeable difference? Is there a drastic difference in the way Christians and non-Christians in this city treat their literal neighbors? If I went to your mayor, your city manager, your police chief, to anyone who is in a position of service here in this community, and I said, "Hey, do you see a big difference in the way Christians and non-Christians treat their actual neighbors?" What do you think they would say? Let me tell you what they would say. Because I have shared this in rooms with leaders from over 500 different cities, and never once has a mayor, police, any civic leader come up to me and said, "Oh, Dave, in my city, the Christians are the best neighbors. It's not even close." Now think about that. If you only do one thing, we're told, love God with everything you have, heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. How do we hold that? How do we reconcile that with the fact that in our cities, on our blocks, in our country, we're not known as the best neighbors in town? How do we make sense of that? I started to like think about that, and it started really get me mad and frustrated. You ever see something on the news and you just start like getting angry? I'm sure like right now that never happens to you. Do you ever see something on the news, you start to get mad? It starts to stir you up? That's what happened to me. I just started to get irritated. And then I asked this other question, and it changed my whole mood. I started to ask this question: I wonder how you end up as a pastor who's not engaged in his own neighborhood. And my emotions went from mad and frustrated and irritated to convicted and reflective. And I started to read passages and stories in the Bible that I had read hundreds of times. And I just started to see them in a new light. I want to share one of those with you this morning. It's a story that you've heard about hundreds of times. I want to ask you to put on some new glasses and look at it through some new lenses. It's found in Luke chapter 10. If you have a Bible, you can turn there. As I've shared my journey with others, I've come to realize that many of us, especially those of us that have grown up around the church, that we've become inoculated to the great commandment. It's one of those things that we hear over and over and over again, and then we lose touch with the true meaning. The reason why we hear this teaching over and over again is because it's really, really good. But in because it's so good, because we end up putting it on t-shirts and bumper stickers and refrigerator magnets, sometimes it's one of those things that we look at and go, "Man, that's good. And then we just go on. We figure out a way to like kind of like distance ourselves from the implications of it in our everyday life. And I think the Bible has something interesting to say about our tendency to do this. So we're going to pick up the story in Luke 10, verse 25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" "What is written in the law?" he replied. "How do you read it?" This happens a couple times throughout the Gospels. Somebody comes to ask Jesus a question. Jesus knows that's not what's going on here. And so he invites the person to answer their own question. And he does, and he gives a great answer. Verse 27, he answered, "Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." "You have answered correctly," Jesus replied. "Do this and you will live." Think about how powerful just that. "Do this and you will live." But look what happens here in verse 29. This is the part that just came screaming off the page at me when I read it in light of what was going on with the mayor and going on inside my heart. But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" This guy goes to Jesus, asks a very straightforward question, gives a very straightforward, good answer. And his first thought is, how do I get out of this? But he wanted to justify himself. Where's the loophole, right? His brain just starts going right away. And it's so interesting how he tries to do it. He's like, "Jesus, neighbor, But what does that really mean? His first thought is, I wonder if I can define that word neighbor in a way that most easily fits into what I'm already up to. He tries to just massage the definition of neighboring to be convenient for him. Do you want to know how you can be a pastor who's not engaged in his own neighborhood? It's right here. You just have to be this guy. All you have to do is try to figure out how to define the word neighbor so that it's really big and nebulous and kind of great. So, and then it can just kind of fit into what you're up to. Do you want to know how we end up as a group of people who aren't known as the best neighbors in town? All you got to do is define this word neighbor so that it most easily fits in to what you're already up to. And Jesus looks at this guy and he says, oh, we're going to play this game, huh? We're going to play the how do you define it game. And he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. It's brilliant. And he takes the definition of neighbor from here and then he just blows it up on the guy. Now, he's assuming that the guy is neighboring with the people of their same culture and custom. And so he tells this incredible story. And you all know the story of the Good Samaritan, right? And you know the big idea of the story of the Good Samaritan, the big idea that really everybody is our neighbor. So there's a problem. That's actually not the big idea of that story. I thought it was. As a pastor for most of my life, how I thought about the story of the Good Samaritan was, you know what? Everybody's my neighbor. That's not what the story says. What the story says is when you care for the person in front of you, no matter who it is, you're being a neighbor to that person. And there's a difference between that and everybody's my neighbor. But I made this little mental gymnastics move to get to everybody's my neighbor. And then I did one more, and this is how you can kind of get totally out of taking the second half of the Great Commandment seriously. You just got to think, everybody's my neighbor. And then you think to yourself, I'm doing a lot of good stuff. I'm kind of just neighboring all the time. You like that? And if you do that, let me tell you what will happen to you. You will end up with a really powerful metaphoric love for your metaphoric neighbors, and metaphorically, you'll be killing it. And in real life, you'll be sleeping 40, 50, 60 feet away from people, and you won't even know their name. And what I've come to learn through this whole thing is really good things happen when we as the people of God just draw a circle around the places that we are and work out from there. That really good things happen when we don't try to start. By the way, the Good Samaritan, that's like AP graduate level neighboring. Okay? Like really good things happen when we as believers, in light of where we're at in our culture, we probably don't need grad school. We actually need to be back in kindergarten. And so as we started to dream with our city leaders about what would it look like to use the believers, the Christ followers in our city to spark and to launch a neighboring movement, we fell into this really simple exercise that we did in all of our churches. We had no idea what the impact was going to be. I want to do it with you here today. I'm going to give you a little quiz, if you would just humor me for a second. You ready for this? So in your program, there's this little sheet right here. It's your notes sheet. It's probably blank right now. I'm not offended at all. So so this right here, take out this little tic-tac-toe board looking thing. Okay, we're all going to do this quiz. I want you to just imagine, if you have a pen, grab one right there. Imagine when you walk outside the front door of your apartment, your condo, your house, whatever it is. Now imagine the 8 closest units to you. Households, apartments. Just imagine the 8 closest. You got them in your head? I just want you to take a second right here. Just write down the names. We'll just go with the adults. Write down the names of the adults in those 8 closest units to you. Just start writing right now. When I first did this, I could fill in both adults' names in 2 of these boxes. And then that didn't feel good to me, and so there was somebody like 20 houses away, and so to make myself feel better, I wrote down their name too. But don't do that. Also, if you could write down real people's names, that'd be great. So like, Don't write annoying lady, okay? If you don't know her name, just leave a blank, okay? Don't write dude who drives a blue car. It's okay. I've been in this moment before. Just leave it blank. Some of you, a couple of you are still writing, which is great. A lot of you are not. Well, just raise your, if you, and maybe I'll just call a couple of you up here. If you can write, if you can list off and fill in both adults' names, if two adults are there, in five or more of those boxes, I want you to raise your hand. Put your hand up. Look around the room. That's like, I'm going to say high and go 35% of the room. I do this little exercise all the time. That's actually really high. Let me tell you something that I think that we should all consider and that should actually have an impact on you. I do this a lot. I sit in rooms of Christians and I ask them to do what we just did. I've never once been in a room of Christians where more than half of the room can fill in five or more of the boxes. Where more than half of the room can write down more than half of their neighbor's names. And I couldn't do it either when I did this for the first time. Let me tell you why I think this is important. My buddy Jay, who wrote this book with me, likes to say this. I'm not a poet. I don't write song lyrics for a living. I'm not a philosophy major. I'm not an expert on love. But I do know this. In order to love someone, it's helpful to know their first name. Awkward laughter here. Let me tell you what happened to me. My wife took a napkin out and wrote like a tic-tac-toe board on this napkin and put it on our fridge. And there was all these blank squares. And because of what was going on inside of my heart and my life, I made a decision that I was going to fill that in. And 2 days after, I'm sitting out there in my driveway, and I look across the street, I look up and over, and there's one of my neighbors, one of my blank squares, he's just mowing his lawn. I'd met him before, by the way. I just didn't remember his name. And I thought to myself, all right, this is my chance. But before I even took a step, I thought, that's pretty weird. He's mowing his lawn. I don't think you should do that right in the middle while he's mowing his lawn. And so I had this second, I'm like, I'll make up something to do in my yard. And when he gets, I'm like, that's more weird. And then I actually had this thought, I thought, I'll go into my house and I bet I'll come out. And right when I did it, I just stopped. I'm like, I'm doing it. I'm trying to look for an out. And I just took this first step and I walked down my driveway and I walked over towards him and he's like mowing and he's looking at me. He's like, what are you doing? This isn't an emergency. Clearly you're not running. And so I just put my head down. I'm like, I don't want to do this. And so I walk up, I walk over, he turns off the lawnmower. And I said, hey, man. That was my name for him. And I have another neighbor that was bro. And I totally kept him separate. And I felt like that was pretty amazing of me as a neighbor to not call him the same name. I said, this is really embarrassing. We've lived next to each other for 18 months. I've met you 3 times and I forgot your name. I don't know it. And he said, I'm Matt and my wife Jan. And we talked for like 15, 20 seconds, and then I went home, and I went to my fridge, and I did something really, really important. I just wrote it down. And after about 6 weeks, this whole thing was filled in. And God, there's all kinds of stuff that sits on my fridge that's just like total white noise. I don't even ever notice it or look at it. It's like my kids' homework and stuff like that. And this, like something, God did something to me. These people went from like people that drove certain types of cars and had a certain number of kids to like real people with real names and with real stories. And they just started to get inside of my thoughts and I started to use their name when I saw them again. It's really important. And it went from like, hey man, to hey Matt, to hey Matt, did you watch that game last night? To hey, I've got this thing in my garage, I just need to move it like 10 feet, could you help me? To, hey, you guys are going to be watching the game, we're going to be watching the game, why don't you guys just come over, we'll throw something on the grill. To, hey, your son's car is back there a lot now, like, Did he move back in? How's that going? To sitting across a dining room table, like sharing our hearts, our dreams, our desires, the things that make us tick. Having conversations that I had dreamed about when I was like trying to like throw some outreach thing at a church, and it was all sitting there as right outside my front door. And all I had to do was walk across the street and take the next small step. And what we realized from this little bitty exercise is that for most of us, the next obstacle standing in the way is just learning and retaining and using the names of the people that live right around us. And sometimes if you take that obstacle out of the way, you'll just start a flow of organic next steps. Sometimes nothing happens. Some of my neighbors don't want to be my friend. They're really busy. And they just fly around doing one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, and then they get home and they just want to get that garage door up and get it down, and they want to detox from everything that just happened to them that day, and then they want to wake up and do it again the next day. And I have a lot of grace for that because that's how I lived most of my life. But some of my neighbors are dying for real relationship. They're thirsting for it. All they have is these surface things that happen at work and like the dysfunctional things that we all have in our families, extended families. And they're dying for somebody just to look at them and say, hey, how's it really going? What are you learning about being a parent? Why'd you choose to be an architect? And I'm dying for it too. I'm dying for it as well. I've learned that proximity-based relationships are like unlike anything else. Affinity-based relationships are the ones that we mostly drift into for the good part of our life. We choose to hang out with people because that person likes the same things I do. That person seems funny. Okay, that person has like cool toys. I want to be friends with them. So it's like I'm rich. I can have cool toys too. So, but proximity-based relationships, you start basing relationships based on proximity, you're going to end up hanging out with people that you would never choose. And it might be hard at the start, but I'm telling you, if you push through that, what's on the other side is incredible. Because they have gifts, they have passions that you don't have, and vice versa. I got into this thinking, this is going to be like this amazing kind of like evangelism deal that like was spread across our city, and what I've come to, and that some of that has happened, but what I've come to believe is this is actually like the greatest discipleship tool. That God will use these relationships to shape us, to grow us, that we get as much out of these relationships as anyone. I've learned a couple things through this. One of the things that I've learned is that almost every time I tell this story, there's a certain percentage of the people in this room that start thinking to themselves, Dave, you're forgetting about some things. I spend more time at work than I do at home, and I'm investing in those relationships, and that's neighboring, and you're not counting it. Dave, I was just on this short-term missions trip, and I sat there in front of this little kid, and I actually fed this kid, and that's neighboring, and you're not talking about that. Or I'm investing in these relationships with these parents on my kids' sports teams, and that's neighboring, and I don't have enough time. Like, listen, all of that, clearly, and I want to be really clear, that is neighboring. Clearly, in Jesus' heart and his definition, that is neighboring. It's loving others. But here's the deal. All of that doesn't somehow like sprinkle magic fairy dust over your actual neighborhood, and all of a sudden Jesus isn't talking about them. And I bought into that. That's how I lived. Like, what if Jesus meant your actual neighbors too? What if when he said, love your neighbor, that they were part of it? And I'm not saying you have to become best friends with every one of them, but what is it like to just be obedient and to take the next small step? And that's what we're doing here today. I love the leadership of this church. I love how passionate they are about neighboring. They bleed this stuff. And what they asked me to come and to share with you today, including my story, is just this challenge. Would you be willing to take the next small step? And from the show of hands that we just had in this room, the next small step is learning and retaining and using people's names. This is my biggest leadership lesson from doing this. My whole life, people said, Dave, set the bar high. That's what good leaders do. Set the bar high. People get close to the bar, they'll get over the bar. Let me tell you what I've learned about starting a movement. The key isn't to set the bar high. The key is actually to set the bar so low that people can't crawl underneath it. Do you know what we're up to here today? The bar's pretty stinking low. We're not asking you to love these people. We're not even asking you to like them right now. We're asking you, would you be willing to learn and retain their names? But I want to tell you something. I feel like I need to be honest about this. It's a Trojan horse. If you do this, you won't be able to stop. If you do this, if you learn and retain and start using people's names, it will blow your mind what happens. Not with every one of your neighbors, but surely with a few of them. There's this verse that's along the way. It's been one of those other verses that I had preached sermons on it, but I had never like really let it sink in. Paul is in Athens, and he's talking to all these people. And he's like, hey, man, I was walking around your city today. You guys are really religious. You have a lot of idols, a lot of gods. I even came across this idol that said, to the unknown God. And he looks at me and says, I'm going to tell you right now about the God you don't yet know. And he goes off on one of the great sermons about who God is and God's character in the New Testament. And as part of that sermon, in Acts 17, he says this. He says, from one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them in the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. He determined the time set for them in the exact places where they should live. Let me tell you what this verse says. You don't live where you live for the reasons you think you do. It's not because you can't afford the place you really want. It's not because you always wanted four bedrooms up or you really wanted to have your kids in this school district. It's because God placed you there and he's placed the people around you there. Do we actually believe this? If you do, you will start to realize something sacred is going on in your neighborhood. You'll start to realize that like when you drive in and out of your neighborhood, that you're driving into a sacred space. You'll start to realize that what you do in your front yard is real ministry. It counts just as much as being a volunteer here or an elder here or anything other great things you're doing. What we do in our front yard counts. And the people here at Christ Church, the leadership here, believe in that as much as any other church I've been around. I'm just watching the way that they've structured the whole church. By the way, this, what we're up to right now, this isn't the point of church. I'm guessing we all know that. These incredible neighborhood groups that they've created so that you can begin, that's not the point either. The point isn't for us just a bunch of Christians to come in and like talk about, you know, the book of John. Like, it's really important, but it's not the end game. And it's an important step. Like gathering based on geography is an important step that a lot of churches don't have. The point is what happens when we go out from those gatherings and we live out the gospel. The point is like what happens? Like those neighborhood groups that a lot of you are in, I'm hoping a lot of you get involved in today, those neighborhood groups, those are times, those are places where we can come back and share the stories, get refueled, recharged. Or sometimes where we can just grieve, or we can be equipped to go and do the real thing. Like, when you start thinking about this, when you run out the numbers on what kind of an impact this has, it gets real interesting. There's about 3,000 households that will hear this message today. 3,000 times 8, 24,000 households could be touched if every single person in this room went home and said, I'm going to go do that low bar thing. And by the way, there's more than one person in each of those households. Let's just guess low and say 3. 72,000 people could be touched by Christ Church if we actually just said, I'm going to take Jesus and what he said literally and seriously. 70, like, get your head around that. By the way, Jesus is smart. If we actually have faith that the way he talks about living is the best way to live, great things happen. So as you leave here today, I want you to consider two things. One, would you be willing to step over the low bar or crawl over it, however you want to do it. Number two, I'd encourage you to go out in the lobby. If you're not already involved in a neighborhood group, that's a gift. Most churches aren't doing it this, they don't have this like available to you. There's these little brochures, you just take out this card and sign a card, somebody will reach out to you and help you get involved in something that's based on proximity. A place where you can come and do life with others and start to think about what it looks like to live out the mission of God in the rest of your life. And the third thing I'd ask you to consider doing is just getting quiet with God today. Spend a little bit of time with Him. And just reflecting on what we've talked about here today. Reflecting on Luke 10. I'd ask God just to speak to you. I want to say something. If you do this, if you just do this, and then you start praying this dangerous prayer, God, what's the next small step that you want me to take with one of my neighbors? If you do that, it'll mess up your life like it has mine. And you'll be grateful. Let's pray. God, thanks for giving us this incredible command that has the potential to do so much for us and for the people that live around us. God, give us a passion and a desire to take the great commandment literally and seriously. Help us to make the time to build relationships with those that you've placed around us and give us the courage to live the kinds of lives that you want us to live. In your name, amen.